Svenska. But you're only one though, so I guess this will leave in English. I'm going to talk to you about Corboot. First a bit of info about myself, then something about Corboot. Lots of stuff about Corboot. History, competition, motivation. Halos is an important concept in Corboot. So we're going to go through that. Some auxiliary tools that the Corboot community has had to develop, has wanted to develop in the course of working on Corboot. Normally I show a live demo, but unfortunately my hardware died. I dropped it on the floor and it didn't start up again. So I'm cheating a little bit and I'm going to show a video recording of a demo that I've done before. So we get to see the good stuff anyway. A bit of talk about attacks and defense applications or scenarios. Conclusion, some personal thanks and links, and hopefully we'll have time for some questions as well. I think so. So my name is Peter Stuge. I'm self-employed in Sweden. I do software hardware security consulting. I was working on a set-top box project, developing a PC really for displaying TV content over distributed over a broadband connection back in 2001, and all PCs have a BIOS, so we needed a BIOS as well, and I was looking into which product to choose and all the options. I found the Linux BIOS project, as it was called back then, an open source BIOS replacement, and I thought this was really exciting. This is a really good thing, because the BIOS market is kind of grim on the consuming end. I stayed somewhat passive until 2006. I was on the mailing list and maybe sent out a few emails, but I didn't do very much work. It was just watching and learning. A fantastic place to learn a lot of stuff about hardware, if you're into that. 2006, we had a developer meeting in Hamburg, in Germany. We got together, a group, couple of days, and I drove down there because it's not very far from Malmö, and I started getting more involved. So now I do work on V3. I try to do a bit of work on V3. I'll come back to the different versions. I work on FlashROM, MSR tool, Philo, a bit of K8. That's AMD64 CPUs, not the very latest Phenom multi-core, but the slightly older stuff. I do support and I do marketing, so that's why I'm here now. Bit of history, Corboot version 1. Sorry for that. Anyway, Corboot version 1 was called FreeBIOS. It was the first try at making an open firmware for the PC. It was a bit of a hack because at the start, it was thought to be really, really simple to do a startup on the PC. That was a pretty big mistake, though. So, the developers, the community learned a great deal from version 1. It does support about 50 mainboards. We do need to put some work into Corboot to support a specific mainboard, each mainboard. We also have the source code split up so that we can reuse support for components. So if you have a new mainboard that uses all the same components as another mainboard which is already supported, odds are that it won't be too much work to get the new one to run. There can be some things that need to be taken into consideration, but it should be that bad. 2001 or so was the start of Linux BIOS version 2. New design, better structure. Not so much a hack. It's still pretty active. It supports about 140-ish mainboards. It's I would say the production version is the version of the source tree that receives the most attention and the most work. 2006 in Hamburg, we started version 3. We learned even more from version 2, and we wanted to improve things a great deal. Usability, for one thing, to sort of decrease the learning curve of getting involved. That was important for me. I still think version 2 has can improve a lot in that regard. We started a new design, much better structure, not so bad a hack. It supports about 10 boards at the moment. They're all GeoLX based, AMD GeoLX. And it's really still in design testing phase. And again, most of the development effort from everywhere is going into version 2. And we put a lot of work into version 3, but maybe not as much as we thought we would. And some of the things that we've learned in version 3 are already coming back, or being introduced, backported, if you will, into version 2. So we try to not let the effort go to waste, even if version 3 might just have been a learning experience. I'm not convinced of that yet, but it seems that because so much effort is going into version 2, maybe that's where the development will continue. Okay, so a BIOS replacement. What does the BIOS do? In PCs, the BIOS really does two things. It does hardware initialization, and after that, it starts up the operating system. It provides interrupt services that the operating system can call and do things like talk to the serial port, read from the keyboard, send outputs to the screen. This is really mostly true for text mode applications or DOS, really DOS operating system. The DOS operating system is pretty much the last one that used these interrupt services very extensively. Nowadays, every operating system has own drivers for hardware, for the keyboard, for the screen, for the serial ports, for everything. So those interrupt services, they aren't used all that much. Why do we think this is a good idea, or what's the problem with the BIOS? It doesn't work the same way it used to in the beginning anymore. The BIOS was essentially a library, a function library, an API that the operating system could call into and do some I/O, basic input output system. So something happened. Laptops started coming along, and when the first laptops came out and the XX closed the lid, something special had to happen inside the system. They couldn't really be expected to do a lot of special things manually. It had to be all automatic when the system, when the lid was closed. So hibernation was introduced, and by the way, or by way of APM, the operating system could shut down, and this was all good. But it introduced a way of sending events into the operating system, or triggering the BIOS from outside the operating system, which was new. And to facilitate this, system management mode was introduced. How many of you know about system management mode? Hands up. What? Okay. System management mode was introduced in the 386 SL CPU by Intel, meant for mobile applications, laptops. Came out in 1990. So it's already almost 20 years old. It's been around for a while. It's in every CPU since. So we all have it. System management mode is a special execution mode where the CPU stops everything it's doing, really, really everything, saves the complete state in a special area that is set up by the firmware, and it runs this pre-configured handler to do whatever should be done. So in the case of the laptop, of course, when the laptop lid is closed, CPU enters system management mode, freezes or hibernates the operating system, and then powers down the system. Along with this execution mode, there was an interrupt signal introduced, so an electrical connection to the CPU, where external devices can trigger this. That's how the lid switch eventually makes the CPU go to the management mode. So it's not only in hardware though. These SMI traps that can be configured are a rule set for making accesses in the CPU to special RAM addresses that I configure or to special I/O addresses that I configure, also trigger system management mode, also jump to this handler. One example that's popular for using this still is PCI virtualization. The PCI bus is standardized and it always uses input-output to special I/O ports in the CPU address space. If these I/O ports are set up so that SMM is triggered, then you can have a SMM handler which behaves like a PCI device. So you have a virtual PCI device. The AMD GeoLX uses this quite a lot. The Geo is really its own architecture. It was originally designed by National quite a while ago, but it's still around. It's a bit special. But through the use of SMM, it can still look like a PCI. And the USB support in BIOSes, the standard BIOSes, it also uses system management mode for USB keyboards. So it took a while before USB keyboards were supported in the BIOS, and in order to really make that work, it's necessary to provide a virtual PS2 keyboard. And PS2 keyboards also communicate, or the operating system communicates with the keyboard and the keyboard controller, also through I/O ports. So again, set up an SMI trap, and whatever the operating system thinks it's talking to a PS2 keyboard, it's really talking to an SMM handler, which runs the USB stack in the BIOS. So the first sort of power management thing that was around was called APM, and it wasn't all that. It was limited in its ways, but fairly clean. The operating system and the BIOS had a good dialogue going on. But it didn't stick around forever. We had ACPI since quite a while already. The advanced configuration and power interface specification from friends at Hewlett Packard and Intel and Microsoft and so on. Phoenix up there is also one of the remaining BIOS vendors. There are really only two now. It's Phoenix and AMI. They bought up everyone else. So revision 3, which is the document I got hold of, is from 2006, 600 something pages, so pretty massive. And it specifies, among other things, a virtual machine. It has its own bytecode and its own programming language. And all of this is in the BIOS. So it runs inside the BIOS, outside the operating system security controls. Really, outside the OS? Is that a terrific idea. So at first they did this, but it turns out it was way too slow. There was a performance hit of about 5%, and that was no good. So this virtual machine had moved into the operating system. Linux got started around 2001. I've heard that at present it's roughly 90,000 lines of code, Kepler's ACPI. And the twist here is that it still operates outside the operating system security model, because it was designed to work that way, and it's really only the way that it's really the only way it can work. So you have better trust your BIOS supplier to give you good ACPI bytecode, because it's going to run in kernel mode, and you can't believe anything about it. To control it, there are no sort of built-in security mechanisms in the ACPI support. So that's the situation, that's the history of the BIOS. Some other players in this area, we have the BIOS. Again, it started out in 78 as tape I/O abstraction. There were two tape drives that you could connect to your PC, and the BIOS was used to be able to start up the operating system or bootstrap, read from the tape drives. The two different tape drives in the same way So an API for abstracting hardware. 2008, now it's 2009. 30 years later, it still works the same way. It has hundreds of function calls, mostly remote. How many know what remote is in 86? So one more, excellent. It's the original execution mode of the 8086 CPU. It's still around in every modern processor, from Intel and AMD and via the PC-compatible processors. It can address a full 1 megabyte of memory, where the top 308K are reserved for special purposes. And that's how your umpteen core duo thing starts up still. And it's the BIOS that sort of shifts it into gear and gets it up to running at full capacity and full performance. So real mode, switching between real mode and protected mode, which is the normal execution mode, that's pretty slow because it's a big change, and also it's complicated because there are many things in protected mode, many new features that are simply not available in real mode, and so you have to work around them, not mess that up. One vendor, I listened to a presentation at an embedded conference. They were telling everyone how proud they were of their codebase, which had 4,300 files for one BIOS. And they admitted that might seem like a lot, but it's modular, so it's really easy to work with. I don't know. Another thing out there is EFI. It's touted by Intel to be the replacement or the successor of the BIOS, the new thing. It's already out there in many systems. All the portable Macs have it, all Intel Macs have it. I think Vista 64 requires EFI as well to start up. Intel ships it out on some boards, and other vendors the BIOS vendors have started shipping EFI as well. So EFI, it's Intel's initiative. It's really an operating system. It has network support, it has a lot of drivers. It's sort of open in a way. They publish the source code for a development kit. They publish an API specification if you want to write plugins for EFI. EFI can use system management mode, so you can have this plugin in the EFI that keeps running behind the operating system if you want to. The Tiana core, the development kit, that's the package from Intel. It's about 250 megabytes to download, compared with the Linux kernel, which is 50 megabytes, so it's pretty big. So Tiana core itself is open, it's BSD licensed, but the BIOS vendors, they don't have open-end products. So we don't really know what's going on inside these EFI products. How am I doing on time? I have 25 minutes? Okay. Thanks. No open-end products. Related products. So Grub and Rhino, they're bootloaders. They come after the BIOS is finished. They're still relevant because they help start up the operating system. ECOS is a small embedded operating system, and Redboot is a bootloader, similar to Grub or Rhino, or similar function, which uses this ECOS embedded operating system. Not used very much on x86 platforms. There's the U-Boot product by DEX in Germany. Very popular for ARM and Power and games. They, I think they started to look at x86 a little bit as well, but it's not very popular on x86 either. So what does CoreBoot do? How does it work inside? We have taken this BIOS task and we've split it up a bit. CoreBoot focuses only on the first part. CoreBoot should only do the hardware initialization and stop there, nothing else. The payload takes over. That's a separate program, completely separate program, which needs to be built together with CoreBoot, or combined with CoreBoot, I should say. But it's the job of the payload to take over. The payload has full control over the system. It's a separate program, as I said. Starts up the operating system, or maybe it it's an application that should run on the system if this is an embedded system and there's no need for a full operating system. You can compile regular programs into payloads and have them start with the delivery. It can also be the operating system itself. So if you have the root, you can put an operating system kernel together with the core roots into your root flash. That's also pretty nice. So, as I said, core boot and the payload, they need to be combined into one file. And that file is then programmed into this small flash chip, which is on every main board. What different payloads do we have so far? We have a whole bunch of bootloaders. We have Philo, which I mentioned is one of the things I work on. It's used for booting from local storage, so hard drives, flash media, compact flash, etc. on IDE, and SATA drives, fine as well. CD-ROMs support too. Etherboot GPXE works as well. That's used for net booting, maybe you've used that already. We also realized the need to be backwards compatible, so there's CBIOS. That's a payload which implements BIOS services, these interrupt services, and the legacy interfaces that is really expected on PCs. Using CBIOS, we successfully start running BSD and Mac OS X and DOS and the various Windows flavors. We can use Open Firmware as a payload. Open Firmware was more popular with Power, maybe, and Spark, Alpha, also, I think. It has some followers. It's a bit of a special environment. Linux, as I mentioned, I think that's the really coolest part of core boot, being able to use the Linux kernel and all of the drivers that are in there as a bootloader. That means that it's easy to boot the system from any device that Linux can support. So if you want to boot from iSCSI, yeah, okay. If you want to boot from Wi-Fi, yeah, okay, we can do that. Group 2, within parentheses, because I'm not quite sure about the development state there. I know there's work being put into it, and it used to be problematic, but I think they have got it running pretty well now. It can also be utilities, as I mentioned. It doesn't have to be a bootloader or the operating system. Memtest 86 is a memory tester, and you can run that already. CoreInfo is really a framework for making simple applications that we developed ourselves. Again, Linux utilities. Maybe you want to put a rescue system into your boot flash, so that even if you don't have a hard drive, you can still boot up your system, get a shell prompt, and mess around there with utilities that you know and like, instead of using strange low-level formatting stuff in some kind of weird configuration. That's also your rescue system in the BIOS would have network support. So you could do everything remotely. That's also nice. Applications. CoreInfo is Memtest 86, both applications or utilities. We ported Tint, a nice game, to run as a payload. That's a lot of fun. It's a Tetris game. Bayou is worth a mention because I said that CoreBoot hands over to one single program, one payload, but maybe it's not enough to have just one of these guys. I want both CBIOS and I want Memtest 86, or I want my utilities image with Linux and some utilities, and I want Tint in there to be able to show off. So, okay, how do I do that? Well, the answer is to use Bayou at present, and Bayou will either be scripted so that it executes a series of payloads in sequence, or it shows a nice user interface. So just pick and choose with the keyboard and hit enter, it will start up that payload. CoreInfo, Tint, and Bayou, and as I mentioned, any really application that isn't highly dependent on the operating system can easily be compiled into payloads using libpayload. Libpayload is a very small C library that we put together. It has many calls, not all of them, but many calls. And there's also tiny curses, which is a curses implementation. So it's possible to make nice text mode user interfaces in your payloads, which is used by GoInfo and maybe also Tinnitus. Yeah, I think Tinnitus uses curses. All right, so I'll tell you two. We have BuildROM, which is the core boot. There's a lot of options there. Payloads, many payloads to choose from, many payload options as well. BuildROM can automate all of this, and using a very simple menu with just a handful of options, you can build everything in one go. That's nice if you don't want to or need to get into the details. Make elf image, sort of oldish. It might not be necessary anymore, but we haven't done extensive testing on that. In order to use the Linux kernel as a payload, which is what I'm going to show in the demo, which is what you'll see in the demo, we have to add a bit of glue to the kernel so that it can start up from the core boot environment that is left behind. It might be possible to actually use the VM Linux kernel file directly. I haven't tried, but that might work. And then we don't need make elf image anymore. NVRAM tool is used to change the bits that are in the PC NVRAM. In every PC, there's 128 or 256 bytes of battery-backed memory. The small clock battery, when the clock on your PC is reset, that's because the battery is out, and then your NVRAM is reset also, and usually the BIOS will complain and say, I've lost all my settings, you need to press whatever keys to reload, and so on. We don't have a configuration interface at runtime, at boot time, but instead we have an NVRAM tool, and the philosophy is that everyone prefers to work in their operating system rather than in this pre-boot environment or during boot environment. So it should be possible to do all the settings at full system runtime. SuperIO tool, Intel tool, and MSR tool are debugging utilities. Very, very valuable for decoding just register states in the machine while we are working on core boot. And there's a special mention of the FlashROM tool, which is used to program the BIOS flash chip in BSD, Linux, Solaris, macOS X. It's not real soon now, it's actually, but works just fine in macOS X. I need to update that. So normally the BIOS vendors, they supply BIOS updates on floppy disks or floppy disk images, and you get to download that, and you have to somehow find a DOS disk, floppy disk, or a DOS CD-ROM and boot your system, and be at the keyboard and run this program, and oh, oops, you have the wrong mainboard. It's GXY8-Q instead of GXY8-A, so this won't work. Sorry. We want to do things in the normal environment, so say in Linux. Works really well. We have this nice cross-flashing feature where we don't do this restriction that you can only program the BIOS image that you that seems to be what your main board is at the moment. So you can use FlashROM to program really any BIOS image to any flash chip on any main board. As long as, of course, the electrical level is compatible. But that really helps because if you're experimenting and one board breaks down, or maybe you had got this BIOS flash chip virus, which got some attention lately, and you want to restore that, you don't have an external BIOS flash chip programmer, but you do have, however, another system that you can use. A normal flashing tool doesn't allow to do that flash of the wrong BIOS content into the chip. FlashROM does that gladly, and it's really a big help. It's also the procedure is to start up the system with a normal BIOS, pull up the flash chip while the system is running, and put the other flash chip in, run FlashROM, and then test the newly programmed flash chip in the target system. It's perfectly safe to hot swap hotspot flash chips, even though it might be a bit scary the first time. But it's really, really safe. It isn't used except at boot time. So Flash ROM supports a long list of different flash chips coming in different sizes and packages and protocols. Flash ROM also needs to know about the chipset, which is on the mainboard because it's on the way to the flash chip. And some 20 plus mainboards which are specifically supported by Flash ROM, but there are also a lot of mainboards that don't need particular support or explicit support. So Flash ROM runs on many, many mainboards, more than just those 23, but they need special handling, and it's there. Also, that works for, again, if the mainboard uses the same layout or a similar layout to some other mainboard, that is, and that other mainboard is supported in Flash ROM, then chances are pretty good that it's going to work just out of the box on also your mainboard. And there's this idea about pushpin flash, which I wish that I could take credit for because it's really genius. So when pulling out and putting these flash chips, pulling out and putting in these flash chips and moving them around, it's easy to lose track of which flash chip has what inside, and it's sometimes the tools aren't really good, so you have to. I prefer to use a screwdriver if I don't do this. So you take a thumbtack for the core boards, the memory boards, and you take out the metal pin first. That's important. Heat it up a little bit so that the plastic gets a bit soft. Pull out the pin and just glue the plastic knob onto the flash chip. So you get a handle, which is really nice, and you can color code them. It's very handy. So
I'm going to show you Core Boot version 3 running on an Alex1C CPU board. That's an AMD GLX CPU. It's a PC system with an AMD CPU, 256 megabytes of RAM. Made by a Swiss company. Pretty nice hardware. Console, and I release reset now. We see Core Boot starting up, and it finds the Linux kernel. The Linux kernel is starting now, and we're up. Yes, it worked.
So that's the demo. It's short, but it's sweet. The boot time is really, really nice. Some attack ideas. I heard we're running low on time. We can do, because Core Boot does the RAM initialization, we can do tricks when the system is starting up. We can stop directly after we've initialized RAM and read out all the information which is in RAM from the previous time the system was running. That's usually a lot of information. All your decrypted SSH keys, for example, should be in memory somewhere, maybe. Especially if routines can send it out through a serial port or wherever. We can do TPM emulation. So if you have music on this fruit box in the corner, maybe all your other systems want to access that as well. And, through the network, we can do some tricks and let the system believe that it's talking to a local TPM, where in fact it's talking to someone over the network. SMM kits, because we can virtualize pretty much anything, we can have a lot of fun. For example, using Bayou and TIPS, we can require someone to wait Tetris before they get to start the system. Defense ideas, the same thing, just the reverse, grab readouts, do memory scrubbing when shutting down and starting up. Clear, make sure to clear all the memory. We can do open case alarms. So whenever someone opens the computer case, shut down the system, clear all the memory. That's a good defense. Within Core Boot, we could do ACPI filtering. Also because of the system management of ACLs. More virtualization, make sure the flash chip isn't available everyone at all times. Bit of conclusion. Good stuff about Core Boot. I think the quick startup time is really nice.
It's open source. It's an open source alternative. There isn't much competition in this field, and it's very healthy to have an open source player, I think. Coreboot itself is GPL, but lib payload is BSD licensed, which means you're free to use it in your applications. Auditability is important. Why are you going to trust your vendor to give you good code? It's written in C, not assembly. Commercial biases are written mostly in assembly language, and there's only so many people in the world that are good at working with assembly language, and there are a whole lot of more people that are good at working with C. So it's much easier to find knowledgeable people that can help you customize or develop your BIOS. We have one source tree, whereas the BIOS vendors have one fork source tree for every mainboard. We want to have good reusability and extensibility, of course, in this tree. So challenges that remain still, we need to do more testing. We have a test system that builds everything, every board on every commit. We also have infrastructure to actually put this image onto hardware, test, see if it boots, and keep track of which revision worked and which didn't. But it's not so easy to hook actual hardware boards into this system, and we need to address that. We also have to polish the boards that we support so that they are really 100% perfect. ACPI is a big deal. We have a Czech Republic guy who does a lot of great work with ACPI. So the conclusion is we have a lot of fun at PowerPoS. So thanks to Peter Eichelson for inviting me to think from Centa for making this event happen, and Mika Holton and David Noah, the community builder, for practical stuff and production and taking care of all the presenters. Webpage coreboot.org, IRC channel, freenode.coreboot. Everything I talked about, coreboot.org/something, use the search function. Questions? No time for questions.
Well, if there's a quick question.
Any questions? No questions. That's you all want to go up here now, I understand.
Okay, then afterwards there is a session in Blenheim, which is the will the minister blog or something. So please leave here quietly through the follow the line outside to the back of so it's called Potenzial Center. So the possible reporting we call it the same thing.